I invite you to turn to Acts chapter 17 as we take a closer look at the subject of the judgment, particularly the investigative judgment, and the question of who is on trial in this judgment. Acts chapter 17, starting at verse 30. I think this is a familiar text to you. Acts chapter 17, starting at verse 30. "And the times of this ignorance God winked at, but now commandeth all men everywhere to repent, because he hath appointed a day in the which he will judge," what's it say?
"The world."
The world. Who's on trial here? The world. "A day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men, and that he hath raised him from the dead." Let's turn to 2 Corinthians for another example. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, and we'll look at verse 10. "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body, according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad." Who's on trial here in this verse? It says, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, correct? All right. How about Ecclesiastes? Let's go to the Old Testament. Ecclesiastes, and let's look at chapter 3. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 17. "I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work." Well, who's on trial here? Righteous and the wicked on trial. Now, there's some other interesting examples in the Bible that I want to look at just briefly. If you turn to the book of Zechariah, Zechariah chapter 3, and we'll start right at verse 1. And here's a prophetic vision that gives us a very interesting depiction of the judgment. Zechariah chapter 3, starting at verse 1. "And he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. And the Lord said unto Satan, The Lord rebuke thee, O Satan, even the Lord that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuke thee. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire? Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and stood before the angel. And he answered and spake unto those that stood before him, saying, Take away the filthy garments from him. And unto him he said, Behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with change of raiment. And I said, Let them set a fair mitre upon his head. So they set a fair mitre upon his head and clothed him with garments. And the angel of the Lord stood by." Now we're told in inspiration that this is a depiction to help us understand the judgment, particularly the investigative judgment that we're talking about this morning. So I want to read to you just briefly from Prophets and Kings, page 587, where we read this: "Zechariah's vision of Joshua and the angel applies with peculiar force to the experience of God's people in the closing scenes of the great day of atonement," specifically dealing with the closing scenes of the great day of atonement. Now, who are the players in this scene in Zechariah chapter 3? Who does Joshua represent? Joshua represents God's people here. That's right. And we see Christ there standing with him, right, to offer a defense. And who else do we see in the scene? Satan is bringing accusation against him. So it's very clear who the players are, who's on trial, who are the charges brought against. Clearly, it's God's people, represented here by Joshua in Zechariah chapter 3. Now, in the New Testament, there's a parable that Jesus told. If you turn to Matthew 22, Matthew chapter 22, and once again, this helps to clarify the question of who is on trial. Matthew chapter 22, starting at verse 1. And this is a kind of a long reading, but I think we should go through it anyway, just to remind ourselves of this story. Matthew chapter 22, and I'll start right at verse 1. And Jesus answered and spake unto them again by parables, and said, The kingdom of heaven is like unto a certain king, which made a marriage for his son, and sent forth his servants to call them that were bidden to the wedding, and they would not come. Again, he sent forth other servants, saying, Tell them which are bidden, Behold, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fatlings are killed, and all things are ready. Come unto the marriage. But they made light of it and went their ways, one to his farm, another to his merchandise. And the remnant took his servants and entreated them spitefully and slew them. But when the king heard thereof, he was wroth, and he sent forth his armies and destroyed those murderers and burned up their city. Then saith he to his servants, The wedding is ready, but they which were bidden were not worthy. Go ye therefore into the highways, and as many as ye shall find, bid to the marriage. So those servants went out into the highways and gathered together all as many as they found, both bad and good. And the wedding was furnished with guests. And when the king came in to see the guests, he saw there a man which had not on a wedding garment. And he saith unto him, Friend, how camest thou in hither not having a wedding garment? And he was speechless. Then said the king to the servants, Bind him hand and foot, and take him away, and cast him into outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are called, but few are chosen. Now, something interesting about this parable, I think it's interesting anyway, that this man was speechless. Why was this man speechless when he was asked a simple question? I want to suggest to you he was speechless because he had no good answer. He didn't have a good excuse. The wedding garment was offered to all of the guests who came to the wedding banquet. So this man not having a wedding garment means he had to turn down an offer, something that was offered to him freely. He turned it down at the door. Now, in Great Controversy, page 428, we're told something about this parable that I didn't understand until just recently. I missed this in the past, but listen to this. In the parable of Matthew 22, the same figure of the marriage is introduced, and the investigative judgment is clearly represented as taking place before the marriage. Had you ever thought of this parable as an investigative judgment parable? Now look, as we keep reading, previous to the wedding, the king comes in to see the guests, to see if all are attired in the wedding garment, the spotless robe of character washed and made white in the blood of the Lamb. He who is found wanting is cast out. But all who upon examination are seen to have the wedding garment on are accepted of God and accounted worthy of a share in his kingdom and a seat upon his throne. This work of examination of character, of determining who are prepared for the kingdom of Christ, is that of the investigative judgment, the closing work in the sanctuary above. Very interesting. This is Great Controversy, page 428. So here we have a parable clearly depicting you have a wedding banquet and the king comes in. Now please notice something. The king does not walk into the wedding feast and ask, how do I look? He does not say, can I have a vote? Am I a fair king? Am I a just king? No, rather he examines the guests to see if they have the robe. You see, the question about the king is not the direct question of the judgment. In fact, in Gospel Workers, page 315, we read this statement. The only question asked in the judgment will be, have they been obedient to my commandments? That's the only question asked in the judgment. Why is that the question in the judgment? Because it answers to the charge that Satan made long ago that man cannot keep God's commandments. Now, I want to make something clear here. As a result of the judgment, God's character is vindicated because you recognize that in Satan's false charge, there is implied an insinuation about God's character. Because if man cannot keep God's law, that seriously creates a dilemma about the character of God, doesn't it? So that is implied. But you see, God never puts himself on trial. He doesn't have to. in answering the question about man, it precludes the question about God's character. In answering the question about man's obedience to God's law, it takes away any remaining question about God's character. So God does not put himself on trial. Now, this is brought to view again in the book of Revelation, which I think is important. Book of Revelation, if you turn there, because, of course, the book of Revelation delivers in great force the judgment hour message. And if you go to Revelation chapter 12, verse 10, we find once again very clearly the position of the players in this trial are all identified. Revelation chapter 12, verse 10. I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. Now notice here, he's not depicted as the accuser of God. He's depicted here as the accuser of our brethren. But notice something. There's no question in the enemy's mind who's the judge. Isn't that right? There's no question who he's charging. He is bringing accusation against who? According to verse 10, the accuser of our brethren. Of us. But notice, the devil clearly understands who the judge is, because who is he coming before? He's coming before God. God is the judge. God is not the one on trial here. Now, in Prophets and Kings, on pages 588 and 589, we have a remarkable little soundbite, as it were, of the enemy bringing accusation against us before God. Listen to the words here. Satan has an accurate knowledge of the sins that he has tempted God's people to commit, and he urges his accusations against them, declaring that by their sins they have forfeited divine protection and claiming that he has the right to destroy them. He pronounces them just as deserving as himself of exclusion from the favor of God. Now here's the little soundbite. Are these, he says, the people who are to take my place in heaven and the place of the angels who united with me? They profess to obey the law of God, but have they kept its precepts? Have they not been lovers of self more than lovers of God? Have they not placed their own interests above his service? Have they not loved the things of the world? Look at the sins that have marked their lives. Behold their selfishness, their malice, their hatred of one another. Will God banish me and my angels from his presence and yet reward those who have been guilty of the same sins? Thou canst not do this, O Lord, in justice. Justice demands that sentence be pronounced against them. Well, those are quite remarkable charges, aren't they? They're kind of disturbing as you listen to the enemy's accusations. But I want to